Club Zero, Paranormal Doing.
Hi, this is Chris Andrews of Club Zero Paranormal. Welcome to another podcast episode. This is episode 5 in our podcast series. Now, our previous 4, including this one, are available to listen to on iTunes, and you can also listen to them and download them even from our website, which is www.clubzeroparanormal.co.uk. Now, episode 4, which was our last podcast, covered aspects of the dangers of the paranormal, meaning the use of a Ouija board, should we or should we not encounter these things, or incorporate these things rather, right through to poltergeists and exorcisms. Now, the reason behind these podcasts is to try and bring you a better insight and understanding of related phenomena that seems to affect thousands, if not millions, of people across the globe worldwide on a daily basis. The paranormal groups everywhere associated in paranormal investigations, but yet so far in this day and age we haven't come up with conclusive evidence. But nonetheless, experiences, encounters do exist. Now, it's trying to bring you the answers and find answers to these age-old questions of what is going on. Now, we know things do go on out there in the paranormal field, but are they paranormal? Are they ghost related? These podcasts are there, are designed to try and find these answers for you at some stage. Now, if you want to join us in a podcast, if you have experiences or encounters to share and you'd like to join us on one of these future podcasts, you can contact us on our Facebook page, which is Club Zero Paranormal, or you can contact us direct by text or phone in 074-555-949-15, or you can email us at clubzeroghost@gmail.com, and we can arrange to have a chat with you in the discussion, and we can put your points across where other people may benefit from your experiences and your encounters. The Club Zero Paranormal podcasts, they bring you news, reviews and interviews. Now, tonight we're going to be interviewing a very well and respected parapsychologist. Most of you, and many of you, know him from television show Most Haunted. It's none other than Dr. Kieran O'Keefe. Now, we will be speaking to Kieran very, very shortly. Now, this is going to be conducted via Skype, so now I would like to apologise beforehand for any loss of sound or interruptions during the interview process. The weather outside at this moment in time is not too good, and obviously Skype is dependent on the airwaves. But ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring you now Mr. Kieran O'Keefe. Right, hi, we've got Kieran O'Keefe, Dr. Kieran O'Keefe on the line joining us by Skype, a very well and credited parapsychologist. Good evening, Kieran, and many thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Not too bad. It's been a while since we've seen each other. I think we first saw each other at a live show when you was doing the live at Maze Artro.
That's right. Yes, that was one of my first. I think maybe my second or third live that I did.
It was a very good show. Was it a 3-day event? I think that wasn't it.
It was a 3-day event. Yeah, and I think the last night, the Maze Artro is legendary because the last night, the studio, where they had the studio and the entire live audience, collapsed, didn't it? They had to evacuate everybody and put them in a separate room, from what I remember.
Right. I remember it well. The weather was atrocious on last time. But I think that's where
I can't believe we're barely 5 minutes in and we're talking about the weather already.
I know, weather's always a big part of everything, even in paranormal terms, I suppose it plays a major
factor. That's true.
Again, thank you very much, Kieran, for joining us this evening. We know you're very, very, very busy, and especially this time of the year, because you've got the launch of your new project. I believe it's with yourself and your lovely wife, Anna, is it? Ghostlands.
That's right, yes. Yeah, it's a project Anna and I have been working on now for about a year. It's a real labor of love between us. And essentially, as people know, I guess, from Facebook and Twitter and us spreading the word, at Halloween at 9 p.m., people navigate their way to YouTube, to Ghostlands Online YouTube channel. They'll be able to see, well, essentially an episode of Ghostlands.
Brilliant. It's brilliant. We've actually put it on our page, on our Facebook page as well. I've looked at the preview, and I'm sure hundreds of others have looked at that preview, and it's very exciting. I can't wait. Is it on the television, did you say, or is it internet-based?
It's on YouTube. It's going to be internet-based. Originally, when we first started looking at doing this, and essentially it came from, you know, me doing investigations, and like I've announced earlier on today, this is an insight into my investigations, albeit with the Ghostlands team. But originally, when Anna and I first started talking about this, our end aim was just to put it on the internet and just to show people and really get feedback.
Yeah.
And people had been asking about my investigations, about evidence, about how do I really feel about this sort of thing. And we just thought, well, it's a great opportunity just to put it out there, you know, and get people's criticisms, but also get positive points, you know, and really get feedback from people like yourselves.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I think it's fantastic. I mean, the preview, I've watched the preview there, and it's had me on the edge of the seat wanting more. You know, I'm sure there are thousands of others out there who are going to be watching it and wanting more. And obviously, you know, like with good people like yourself, it's I'm assuming it's going to be based evidentially, you know, and things like that, where there's more evidence that seems to come to light, because you do more things on a scientific level, I'm assuming, there, Kieran.
Yes, my background is definitely as a scientist, and a lot of people would argue as a scientist and parapsychologist, I wouldn't normally be involved in ghost hunting, so I wouldn't be out in the field. Normally a parapsychologist would be involved in laboratory research, looking at various aspects of the paranormal, but it's only because I was a ghost hunter first, before I became a qualified parapsychologist, so I've always had the bug, as it were.
Right.
And this really, you know, this really is just me taking my experience as a ghost hunter and also as a parapsychologist. So yes, you're right. I think I mentioned it in the announcement that it's not about the people in the Ghostlands. It's about the evidence. That's, and it's really letting the evidence speak at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's the most anybody can want, is the evidence. I mean, there's so many paranormal investigations are conducted throughout the world, and so many organisations have set up television programmes, and yet we never have the conclusive evidence to actually state that there is, we know that there is things that do go on out there, but it's trying to formulate what these things actually are, where there's no actual evidence, I don't think, at the moment today, to support that ghostly activity actually exists in a concrete world, you know.
You're absolutely right in terms of, well, there's two parts to that. When we talk about evidence, we're talking about evidence for potentially what, for people's haunting experiences, or are we talking about evidence in terms of an afterlife or a spirit coming back from the dead? Who's to say? But ultimately, as ghost hunters, we have our own individual views about what is evidence. Is it EVPs? Is it photographs? Video? Is it environmental changes, which are unusual, temperature changes, that sort of thing? Or is it people's subjective experiences? And I guess what I'm, where I'm coming from is twofold. As a scientist, as a parapsychologist, it's very difficult for me to look at people's subjective experiences and say it's proof of anything. It's evidence for that particular person. And it doesn't mean that I'm cynical by saying that. In fact, quite the opposite. I'm saying that I'm being genuinely open-minded. And when people have haunting experiences, it is evidence. We cannot deny that they are presenting that as evidence. My question throughout Ghostlands, and I think my question whenever I do anything like this, is always, is the evidence proof?
Yeah.
That's what we've got to keep asking ourselves.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think for some people, or maybe for most people out there, it doesn't matter how much evidence is brought to light. There's always going to be people there that are going to doubt that evidence, are going to question the evidence and still will be convinced maybe that there is aspects of the afterlife that do exist or maybe not exist because people are sort of set in the ways, you know. I'm a fully trained security operative, and obviously, you know, I've conducted and used CCTV cameras, you know, in different places. But I mean, if you look at all the CCTV cameras in all the towns in all over the globe, and there's no actual evidence of anything. Yeah. You'd think there would be with all those implements everywhere, you know. But
yeah, you'd expect it, but then it comes down to, I wouldn't say it's a psychology question, but it comes down to a question of, well, what exactly are you looking for? Because if the CCTV, you know, a CCTV operator that's sitting behind a bank of screens watching a high street in some provincial town, they're going to be looking for potential crime to then report it or forward it on to the police or get somebody involved who can stop that crime ultimately. Or whether it's assault or whether it's some sort of vandalism, they're not going to be looking for ghosts.
True.
That's talking the thing. So it sounds like I'm veering off to the other side of the fence when I say we have all of these thousands and thousands of CCTVs worldwide, but are people looking at those CCTVs with the intention of seeing if there's a ghost there?
That's a very good point. I think sometimes things do get drawn to light when unintentionally, like the you've got the spinning statue at the Manchester Museum, etc., in different places. I suppose you do get drawn to light. But speaking of crime and things like that, excuse me, you're actually obviously an applied parapsychologist, and you've specialised in both crime forensics as well as the paranormal.
Yes, yeah, I'm actually responsible for several degree programs at a university in Buckinghamshire. One of the degree programs is criminological psychology, which is accredited by the British Psychological Society, and the other degree is psychology and criminology. And also there's a police studies degree as well that I'm kind of jointly responsible for. And so I do have two hats. One is the parapsychology hat, and the other one is very much criminal or criminological psychology.
That's absolutely fascinating. I mean, excuse me, frog in the throat there. I mean, looking at the specialities that you have, do you ever, you combine, like, together, let's say, during investigations, would you ever find yourself maybe trying to create a paranormal-based psychological profile of whoever...
Like a paranormal-based psychological what?
Excuse me, a paranormal profile. You know, let's say you're on an investigation...
Yeah,
and you were the medium, say, or the investigators who were with you, and they're detecting the presence of whoever may be or may not be there. And obviously, with your expertise there on the crime and forensics, would you find yourself trying to put together a profile, like a photo fit, as it were, of the person?
It's a very good point. And generally, I keep my crime hat very distinct and separate from my parapsychology hat, apart from researching areas like psychic criminology, you know, psychic detectives, that sort of thing, that combines both hats. But in terms of investigations and bringing in the crime stuff and being kind of an offender profiler, if you were, if we call the spirit the offender, no, I don't tend to do that, but I guess I do it in a very basic way that any ghost hunter out there would do. And so, for example, if there are ghost groups out there who use trigger objects, a very kind of basic form of profiling is saying, well, there's this supposed spirit in a location. What sort of trigger object would be best to use that the person who supposedly haunts this place would interact with?
At some point
in the past, I think all groups used crosses as trigger objects. But then the argument is, well, if there is actually anybody there, why would they even involve themselves with a cross unless they were devoutly religious? Whereas, you know, if you and I were walking along the street today and we saw a £5 note on the floor or a pound coin, we'd probably stoop over and pick it up. Well, the argument could be maybe a spirit would do the same thing.
Well, that's exactly right. When we're doing investigations, we did an investigation the other night, and I have a part of my trigger object collection of various coins from different eras in time. And I think because we was at a place called Eam the other night, which is in Derbyshire, where for the plague village, and obviously the plague is related to the 1600s. So obviously one of the coins that I used there on a trigger object basis was a 1646 coin. So as you've just said there, because if someone was walking, that's the only thing I think that would identify with any. If you use different coins from different periods, obviously venues, I believe, you know, may contain energies from not just one period, but from various periods. So maybe different coins from these different eras may attract, as you just said. You see a £5 note on the floor, you're going to pick it up, you know.
Well, see, there you go. And that's, in essence, an example of profiling. You're looking at the characteristics of the spirit that's in the location and kind of understanding what their personality is. Mm. I think beyond that, to then go into greater depth in terms of personality is something I don't do, and I don't know if people necessarily do, or maybe at some level that could be what mediums do, essentially, without realizing it. They may be in a position where they think that they're in contact with a spirit, or maybe they genuinely are in contact with a spirit, but maybe there's some aspect of amateur profiling that's going on, and they're building up a personality profile of the person they're in contact with.
Yeah, exactly. Talking of mediums, I mean, you've worked alongside some very well-known mediums, and, you know, of course, I myself, I retain a sceptical, I'm very sceptical view of such. I mean, until I can prove and validate information that I've received. But has any of the information with mediums that you've worked with along the time, has any actually left you maybe in awe with its unquestionable accuracy and any certainty that you are, you know, that you're sure couldn't be gained from prior research or dry reading?
It's a tough one, really, because my initial answer would probably be no. Hmm. It's my first reaction, thinking about the hundreds of mediums that I've worked with, the few that I've worked with on various shows on television. And generally, I always take a very skeptical viewpoint of mediums. And I always think about the possibility that they could have gained the information beforehand. On occasion, David Wells has made me scratch my head. I will go that far. And he's come up with interesting information about locations that I wasn't aware was known, or at least wasn't publicly known prior to visiting that location. But I think David also impresses me anyway in terms of being a medium who is spiritual, genuinely spiritual, and seems to be somebody who has taken a journey in terms of education, like trying to work out what he's doing. He's a well-read medium. He's done lots of training in various aspects of different parts of the paranormal, so in terms of hypnotherapy and that sort of thing. So, you know, I'm quite impressed with him as a spiritual person, more so than anything else. But I've worked with a few different mediums. Chris Conway, for example, I have a lot of respect for, various other mediums. But in terms of, have I ever had any information that's blown me away? No. It hasn't happened at all. And the surprising thing about working with these hundreds of mediums, and it is literally hundreds now, we're about 250 mediums that I've been working with over the years since I've been involved in parapsychology. I think two of them have given me readings.
Right.
That's only two of them. And I think maybe it's because I come across as too skeptical. So they're very wary about what I'd say.
Would there be any form of accuracy in those readings that you received that you could sort of validated?
No, absolutely not. The readings that I got were so incredibly vague and ambiguous. I couldn't read. I could read a lot into them, but no sense of accuracy from the readings at all. And in fact, one of the mediums actually gave me a reading and said at the time that I was single and that it would be at least 10 years before I met somebody. And I had just been married a couple of months before. Yeah, so not very good.
That's fair enough. It just goes to show. I mean, I have spoke to mediums in the past myself, and again, you know, like yourself, the credibility. And that's not to disrespect or to not mediums. I mean, I'm sure there's some very, very good mediums out there who do get a lot of things on an accurate side of things. But unfortunately, I think in this day and age, I think a lot of people are dependent on wanting answers or contact from the loved ones. And I think, you know, and that seems to happen. If somebody really wants something enough, they tend to believe more or less anything that's given over to you. You know, just to get that reach out.
I completely agree with that, Chris. And I think that happens a lot outside of hauntings as well, in terms of theatre and one-on-one readings and that sort of stuff. But it's quite interesting when you look at history of parapsychology. There are some researchers who have used mediums in investigations in a very clever way, and that is using the argument that, okay, if you leave aside the fact if mediums are actually talking to the dead, let's forget that for the moment, and let's go from the basis that maybe what we're looking at with mediums is that they are more attuned to the location in some way, some sort of emotional radar, if you will. So they're more empathic maybe, or more sympathetic. It doesn't mean that there's something paranormal going on. They might be more empathic to a location or things that have gone on in that particular location. The same way that if you walk into a room and there's just been a blazing row between two people in that room, you can often sense that that's the case.
Yeah, indeed.
And it's nothing paranormal going on. And so maybe with mediums, a lot of mediums have that heightened awareness. And so it's perfectly possible then to use mediums in an investigation to see what information they come up with, to maybe focus more on the emotional aspect of what they're coming up with, but also not to focus the investigation around what they say, to have the medium as part of the investigation, but to use their experiences and catalogue them and log them in the same way that you would anybody else in the team.
Yeah, exactly. I fully agree with you there. Equipment, sir. Equipment. Now, I know you're not a massive lover of the the EMF meter, and especially the K2 meter. I know you're not a big, and I also know that you're a bigger fan of the temperature, and you know, within the ambience of the temperature changes, and obviously that does sort of stipulate more to the fact of maybe a presence of some form where the temperature is constantly changing, and maybe for no specific reason, especially once it's been baselined and the windows and the drafts and all this has been checked. But what type of equipment? Because I've got a message from it's a question from Paul Rowlands, actually.
Paul. Yes, I know Paul.
Oh, you know him. He's a great guy, Paul Rowlands, and we know him well. He's done some work with us along the time. In the past, but he has wrote and he's asked me to ask you if there's any commercial technology that you believe is relevant to detecting the presence of a spirit, or if not, what type of technology would you like to build for that specific purpose?
The answer to that is no. I don't believe there's any technology out there that's essentially a spirit detector, unless you take the argument, or unless you take the logic in a very different way. And by that I mean EMF meters are not spirit detectors per se.
Yeah.
So they changes in reading is not detecting spirit. However, if somebody has a haunting experience, say they have a sense of presence, and you have an appropriate EMF meter, not a K2, but you have an appropriate EMF meter that measures the sort of fields that can affect your brain in such a way to give you the feeling of a sense of presence. If they're actually there measuring that, and they're measuring that at the point where somebody has that feeling of a sense of presence, and the EMF meter shows that there is no presence of those fields, then essentially what you're saying is potentially that person is having a genuine experience. Mm. You see what I mean? Because you're discounting the environmental explanation for what's going on. So if you reverse the logic about some of these gadgets and say, okay, well, some of these environmental gadgets are useful because they're measuring genuine environmental variables such as temperature, humidity, even static electricity, EMF, you name it. And all of those particular variables can have an effect on a person's body in such a way that they think they're having an experience. They have an experience and you're not measuring that stuff, then it means maybe you've got a genuine experience. So that's the first part of Paul's question. And the second part is he says, you know, if is there anything that I would like to construct or have built that would detect the presence of spirit or some aspect of it, which I think is a great question, and also a great question coming from Paul Rowland, given he's quite an amazing inventor himself.
It's fantastic.
Various wonderful gadgets. Yeah, having seen a number, I've been very impressed by his wizardry. But in terms of, is there anything I would want built? All right. Let's say we have the sky's the limit to this. If there was anything that I would want built, it would be something to see ghosts. Yeah. That's all it would be. That's all it would be. You know, we talk about seeing ghosts on film and on camera and capturing that, and the very, very tiny percentage of it is intriguing. The rest is ambiguous, is dubious. We can't really tell what it is. And do these ghosts that are captured on film reflect the sorts of experiences that you hear from people about seeing, you know, somebody like Henry VIII and various figures, but seeing them very clearly?
Yeah,
I'd like to see some sort of technology that could actually make us see ghosts if they're there.
Well, that would be good. I think that'd probably be everybody's you know, dream, really, to acquire such. And like you said, Paul Rowlands is a very good inventor, and the equipment that he makes is phenomenal. You know, it really is phenomenal. But I mean, although I do like gadgets and I do like equipment, and I do believe that some equipment can aid in the fact of paranormal research as we go along at some stages, but I'm also sceptical regards other parts of equipment, because I do believe that other equipment can create or add to the fact, you know, to alleged paranormal activity, i.e. if you're walking along with an EMF meter and you're taking a photograph at that same time. Now, we've noticed that when you click on your camera, it spikes your EMF meter. So obviously these are not as accurate, you know, or they may actually create these people experiencing certain things. Do you find that?
Yes, I agree with you in that respect, that we're especially when it comes to EMF meters, and K2 as well is quite guilty of it. You know, people are going out there with their K2s trying to look for EMF sources or the spirits that they think are going to affect K2. But what people aren't aware of is the whole variety of things that can affect a K2 meter, you know, which is even down to potentially Wi-Fi. Walkie-talkie and something flying overhead. There's lots of things that can affect it. What's interesting about your question is the implication or the added part to it of whether we can affect the meters in a particular way. Is that what you're saying?
I think so.
If we can affect it in a particular way, interesting theory. I think in terms of temperature, I would say that could easily be the case. You know, in terms of how we react to a particular location can increase or decrease our body temperature, and that could be picked up by a particular meter, so we could affect it in that way. Essentially, what you're talking about is from my perspective, is a form of PK, affecting a gadget. Using our mind, either consciously or subconsciously, is a form of PK. And the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab over in Princeton, which is now closed and has been closed for, I guess, over a decade now, they were looking at exactly that, whether people can affect machinery in that way. One of their key themes of research was seeing whether people can affect the decay of radioactive material. And they would argue, Brenda Dunn and Robert Yarn, who are the researchers at Princeton, they would argue that you can affect machinery, even consciously or unconsciously, without realizing it. But you know, I have to take a step, big step back, and say there's a caveat to that, which at the moment is only theoretical. But it's down to, you know, it's down to people like yourself. It's down to groups, I think, out there now, to do this sort of research while they're out in the field.
Well, exactly, exactly. I mean, my favorite part of you know, in the paranormal field, excuse me, is electronic voice phenomena, you know, EVP, the detection of you know, alleged disembodied spirits or voices out there. Personally, I mean, I like to look at things. I'll never take anything as gospel. I've always got to question everything, you know, like yourself and then a lot of other people out there. One of the things I'm currently looking at or trying to figure out is the possibility maybe that maybe could people's thoughts, in a sense, in an essence, also be responsible for certain types of EVP, as it was, you know, like in a thought suggestion or in a thought suggestion when people are thinking, you know, when people think things, and then so you'll find where the synchronicity seems to come into play. Somebody else might think, oh, I was just thinking that.
Right.
Or you're thinking that the telephone's about to ring and then the telephone rings, or you're thinking of a letter from somebody and you get you get a letter, you know. And I just want, you know, and when people walk down the street and suddenly they'll think, oh, sausages, that reminds me, I need to go and buy a packet of sausages, let's say, from a supermarket. Is that because somebody, you know, could it be that somebody prior has walked down there, that same path, thinking the same thing, oh, I need to go and buy some sausages, and we can be picking up on people's thoughts and emotions in that respect. I mean, the list goes on and on, you know, and it's probably a never-ending scenario.
And I think it's a fantastic idea, and immediately the neuropsychological side of my training would jump in and go, well, you know, there are millions and millions of networks and pathways that are going on in our brain. That means we're processing at a rate that no computer would ever do.
Exactly.
As you know, as it currently stands, and maybe for the foreseeable future, the amount of processing that goes on in our brain. And so who's to say what sort of cues are responsible, you know, for us walking down the street and thinking, oh, sausages, you know, there's no way of knowing that. But I think the other side of it that you're talking about in terms of, do our brains in some way or our kind of willing in some way affect audio recordings to produce EVPs? That's a tough one. And it's a tough one because we're also going from the standpoint that EVPs are spirit voices from the first side of it. Now, EVPs, I think I've always maintained, form some of the most convincing evidence that's been put forward in the ghost hunting field, and it's stuff that goes back to Constantine Rorty, you know, over 50 years ago, Jurgensen and various other researchers who've done some amazing work looking at EVPs. And I think it is. I think it's fascinating stuff. But I think from my skeptical point of view, I need to be wary, because one of the things that I see frequently, and I've been guilty of it myself on occasion, is listening to those EVPs, listening to those recorders, going through hours and hours of audio footage or audio captures, listening out for that discarnate voice or listening out for an interesting word that means something. And we very much read into it the evidence, I think. We read into that a lot of that static and a lot of that noise. We read into it words and names that we want to hear. And it's just something to be very wary of. And I think it's a circular argument. You and I can have this argument over a beer one night, and the night would go on forever, because it's essentially saying these voices that are captured on recordings, are, first of all, are they there? Well, yes. If you and I were both hearing them, then they'd be there. I would be saying, well, we're reading into it that it's saying, get out. Whereas your theory is saying, well, maybe what's happening is I was thinking Get Out, and therefore I planted that voice or that word on the recording. And you know, aside from psychology research that shows that we can see patterns in randomness and things called pareidolia, I think you and I would just constantly go back and forth because the evidence for it kind of fits both theories.
Well, yeah, it does. It does. I mean, people do think, you know, they think things, they possibly hear things that may not be saying certain words, like you've just said yourself. If you're listening to EVP, and a lot of it sometimes is very distorted because of the background sounds and the situations in how these are recorded, and maybe on some of the appliances of recorder, you know, the recorders themselves, and they hear these. You know, I mean, we've done it ourselves. We've heard voices and, you know, and things that have come back out on there. And they're very hard to detect on some of what they're actually saying. But then I suppose we put out, and a lot of other people put yes. out, that they think it sounds like this. So therefore, it must be that. But why? The reason why yeah. I said maybe is it possible for our, you know, tools to create such EVPs, maybe from our own perception of our own thoughts, is very much on the same process of where residual energy may be contained within the fabric of a building is thought to be created from emotions and essences that have been recorded in time, you know, on that level. So could it possibly work? I mean, people go into these buildings and they hear voices or, you know, and things like that, or and they record these. So are these, again, contained within the essence of the building and in the fabric, i.e. as in a residual format?
Hence yeah, you're tapping into stone tape theory, and that, you know, stone tape theory and its precursor, which was water tape theory, this idea that there's some sort of emotional imprint on the fabric of a building that then is replayed at a certain point, or replayed because of some environmental cue or some drop in temperature. And these are all theories, and you know, it's what keeps us going in the ghost hunting field in terms of trying to explain the phenomena that people experience. But I do come at it from a very different perspective, which is it trying to explain, for me, trying to explain a theory or give a theory as to why this phenomena is happening. You have to, as a scientist and a parapsychologist, first of all, say that this phenomena is genuinely happening, i.e. there is definite proof out there. And for me, I'm still at that point where I say there's evidence out there, and there's some very, very good evidence out there, but have we yet reached the stage where it's become proof? Exactly. And, you know, I still remain a little skeptical about that.
Will we ever accept it as proof? That's, you know, that's again, that's, I mean, we probably go on for years and years, and will we ever actually accept it? I think maybe part of me actually thinks, you know, believes or hopes maybe that we don't really want to accept it as proof, because it's, I think, by not gaining that proof is what keep, like you just very much said there, it spurs us on and keeps us going, you know. And I think we can step ourselves outside of that box and, you know, and explore. It's to some people, maybe in the paranormal field, it's like more like an evolution where we're sort of evolving ourselves into something a little bit more, because it's not just about the paranormal and understanding the energies or the alleged energies that may or may not contain, but I think also you're starting to understand yourself as a person and understand others, and maybe you're developing yourself as well more in an emotional aspect, and enveloping your own mind in the world of seeking knowledge and expanding your horizons.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I very much see ghost hunting as a journey. Mm. You know, that you look at people that step into or come into ghost hunting for the first time, and they come from a whole variety of backgrounds, some skeptical, some cynical, some believers, some dogmatic believers, some quite indifferent, and then they end up on a journey. Sometimes people are hooked, and like you say, it becomes a knowledge seeking exercise, and how they interpret evidence, how that belief fits, how that evidence fits into their belief structure and alter them as a person. So you know, I don't want to be sitting in this position chatting with yourself, a fellow ghost hunter, and us talking about how grand and amazing it is and how life-changing it is. But ultimately, anything that we do on a daily basis is going to affect us and have some impact on our belief structure and personality. And ghost hunting can have a great influence on people's personality and belief structure.
I think it does, yeah. I think you're very right there, Kieran. I think people, obviously, they've got an ability to learn as well. You know, the ghost hunting side of things. I mean, you've got different aspects of the ghost hunting, how I look at things anyway. People may disagree, some people may agree. I think you've got variations. You know, you've got ghost hunters, you've got scaremongers, you've got paranormal investigators, you know, and, people, scaremongers who just want to come, you know, it's all in the same tie, where they just want to scare people, and because we all seem to like that fear factor. Sometimes I think that fear factor is missing, and then you've got the ghost hunters who maybe just go in there, shine a camera, point it in, hope to hell that they've just got something on the camera, and then walk away and leave it at that. And then obviously paranormal investigators who take a more in-depth approach and start to conduct the research and to explore every avenue that, because I think every avenue that's given contains doorways, and every time you venture through a doorway, then there's more doorways to explore. And I think that's an enhancement, and combine them together, people can learn from each other, and they develop again a knowledge. And like you just said, you know, people can start off very small, taking, you know, a couple of friends going to a local cemetery, because, you know, and a lot of people do that because they've seen these things on the TV and maybe they don't quite understand the best ways of doing these things, but they certainly expand themselves, I think, in time by being associated all with other people.
Yeah.
So it's a learning curve, isn't it? I think, you know. So I mean,
definitely. You know, and people always ask me about ghost events and public events and being quite down on them. But I think you not hinted at. I think you were saying about the different motivations for people going into ghost hunting and the different approaches. There are so many different approaches that people take, so many different methods, but also so many different motivations and intent in terms of the ghost hunt that a group or an individual might do, and who's to say what is right and who's to say what is wrong. But at the end of the day, if you're going to go in and scare people and say, oh, we found some amazing evidence, then I'd be very critical of that. Whereas if you're going to go into the ghost...
Exactly. I have another question from somebody else on our Facebook here, and if that's all right. It's from Emma Knight, and she wanted to know, she's one of our team members, she wanted to know if there was any... No problem. Okay, can you hear me all right now, Kieran?
Yes, I can hear you fine now.
Okay, okay. I have a question for you from Emma Knight. Who
I can hear you all right.
Brilliant. That's the wonders of technology. That's Skype and the airwaves for you. Emma Knight, she's one of our team members, and she's asked if you've ever had any experience that have made you question from a skeptic point of view.
Yes. Well, I've had hundreds of experiences that other people might interpret as paranormal, but in terms of any experiences that made me scratch my head, I would say two particular locations. A now closed down nightclub in Birkenhead, where some interesting phenomena happened with a fire exit door and also captured on a thermal imager, and also a bunker on the Channel Islands, an underground bunker. I was in a room and heard some footsteps outside, which kind of made me scratch my head. But it's more so one of those locations that you go into and you have a sense that there's an atmosphere change.
Yeah.
And it's one of those weird situations, because as a rational psychologist, I'm always thinking that there's a rational explanation for it. And if I try and explain it to colleagues, they're very quick to laugh it off and say, oh, you're talking rubbish. But then ghost hunters generally, they know about locations, or they may have had an experience in a location where you walk in and it just feels as though there's an atmosphere difference, some sort of atmosphere change when you go into a particular location. I'm not claiming any sort of psychic ability at all. It's just one of those places, this underground bunker, that I visited that was just weird, just bizarre, sort of spooky feeling.
Some things can't be quite easily explained, can they? I mean, I understand what you're saying. I've been to some venues myself, and it's been like that. I've been to other venues, you know, and I've not really experienced, you know, anything. Now, I know you've done over, is it about 1,600 various types of investigations along the lines, and probably about, what, 250, 300 were then with Most Haunted?
Yes, yeah, easily. Yeah, loads.
So, you know, myself included, I mean, well, I mean, I've met the cast of Most Haunted and, you know, on several times, and yourself on several times, but, and we've been to locations where you guys have been in the past, like, I, you know, when Most Haunted went to Margam Castle and to Derby Jail, etc., etc., and, you know, to try and sort of experience the things that happened along the lines there, but I have, you know, when Most Haunted actually went there, but... there's things that I have experienced in places where I haven't experienced in other. So like yourself, I have certain areas that I think is quite unique, you know, like your two, your favourite experiences. And just talking about most.
Yeah, and it's one of those questions, isn't it, in terms of, is it going into one of those particular locations? Is it something to do with your particular mood on that day or that hour? Is it something you ate earlier on that day? Is it something about one of the environmental variables in that particular hour? Temperature, humidity, air pressure, who knows? Something natural, perfectly natural, that we immediately interpret as being because of, you know, a haunting atmosphere or some sort of presence in the location. But for me, what makes it fascinating is that when you try and explain it to rational scientific colleagues, they are immediately dismissive, and they say, oh, it's down to suggestion and you knew it would be haunted and that sort of thing. Well, no, if you visited hundreds and thousands of locations, then you're not easily suggestible when it comes to locations. And it's just one of those things that I think is good for people to experience so they know what it's like. And I'm not saying it's paranormal. I think it might have been one of those other natural explanations, but it's just, it's an interesting subjective experience that you can't really explain to people.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, so a lot of people may go to, you know, to venues and their expectations are high of experiencing things, especially if they go to somewhere like Margam Castle. And it's gothic looking. It's like something straight out of a whole, you know, out of a movie, a horror movie. And I think their expectations and their hopes, and maybe sometimes people can have experiences because of these expectations when they're not technically having an experience of a paranormal nature, but just because their hopes of what the actual venue represents or looks like to them can probably cause a massive factor. You know, in such, you know, I have a question for you from Paul Jackson on our Facebook, and he's asked, because obviously Most Haunted have started filming again, so they've come back together. Now he's asked if you're going to be part of the new Most Haunted show at all.
Oh, am I going to be part of it? No, I'm not involved in that. I understand that they are doing a new show, and I wish them all the best and good luck with it. But no, my time is now taken up with a lot of parapsychology work, a lot of writing, a lot of very intense and scientific research. And in addition to that, doing as well my school of parapsychology. And also, as you said at the beginning, Ghostlands. You know, that's taken up a lot of my time.
I hope Ghostlands is going to be something that's going to continue. Is it going to be just a project, or is it something that you're hoping is going to continue and, you know, just keep carry on going? And
it's an ongoing project. Let's put it that way. I just need basically to go and to watch it. The more people that watch it, the more feedback that I get. You know, it's a dynamic, organic project. So we'll see where it develops. Let's leave it at that.
I think a lot of people are. I think a lot of people are going to watch it. I think you're, you know, especially one of the nation's favourite parapsychologists there. So people are certainly going to watch it. I know I will, and I know the Club Zero members and many other people out there. And the teaser that you know, I've looked at the teaser. The teaser that you've put on there, which I've put on our Facebook page, is phenomenal.
I didn't get the last part of that question.
Oh, sorry. I know a lot of people are going to watch it. I know I'm going to watch it, and you know, great, you know. It's left me on the edge of the seat, you know. It's one of those. It's it just grips you, and obviously you're going to be looking for. Everyone's
just completely dropped out. We were talking. I think you were talking about
what? Sorry, Ghostlands. We was talking about. I think it was your Ghostlands. We was reflecting on there.
Yes. Yeah.
I think it's a weather issue going on.
And here. I think you would. Could be. Yes. Could be. Yeah, but at the end, we'll see what happens Halloween evening. People need to gravitate to the YouTube channel and watch what myself and Anna have been working on for the last year and feed back to us as well.
We'll certainly do that. We'll certainly do that. And if you're ever up in this area, in the Greater Manchester area or the Stockport area, and, you know, we're always available to help and assist you with anything that you want to do on the Ghostlands. Believe me, we certainly are. So, you know, if...
brilliant.
Well, that'd be fun. No, I do know
definitely
that...
Definitely better.
Sorry? Say again, Kieran.
I shall definitely bear that in mind because I know we're travelling about quite a bit.
Well, please do. I mean, we'll always be glad to help and assist. You know, it'd be fantastic. Now, I do know that you do liaise with other groups and organisations if they're in the local area, because obviously travelling around, you know, and things like that. So I know there's a lot of people that would relish the opportunity to, you know, to work alongside you. I know I'm one of them, you know, and you know, I think we'd go far with all these great minds that think alike on that level. So can I possibly read out another question for you before, in case we lose connection again, and then we'll...
Okay.
Okay, yes. Let me see. Now, I've got one from Michaela Bolden. Again, she's from our team. And she's put, of all the investigations that you have done with Yvette and Kyle, Carl, what has been your best location that you felt the need to return, and why?
I think it would have to be... that's a tough one. Actually, because there's quite a few that I'd like to go back to. Pendle Hill, but it's a location I don't think we'll ever go back to. Lower Wellhead Farm, in just outside of Clitheroe, which is the site of the famous Pendle Hill Halloween weekend.
Yeah.
Love to go back there just because of a few things that happened in terms of, you know, the group... various members of the group fainting, collapsing, that sort of thing, and also various phenomena being experienced. I'd like to go there with maybe some of the same again, but also a different group as well, just to see what sort of phenomena happens. But I don't think we will be able to now, because I think the building that particular farm has now been refurbished. Beyond that, I would say the Queen Mary at Long Beach, which is a huge, huge ship, Long Beach, west coast of America. I was there for about 2-3 weeks. Just the vastness of it is somewhere that you would have to have a good team working all hours, taking shifts and investigating the place almost continuously. But I would love to go back for a lot longer with more guests and more teams.
That'd be fantastic. I've never been to the ship itself, but Pendle, I mean, you're very lucky. We only live around the corner from Pendle, so if you ever want to go back, come up in this area, give us a shout, and we'll be happy to.
All right.
You know,
of course.
It was there the other week, actually, up in Pendle, having a look there. But it's an interesting place, Pendle, very interesting place. So if you're ever in the neighbourhood, you know, you want to go back and do some research, then I'm sure we can assist you on there, which I think would be good.
We can sort something out, can't we? Definitely.
I'm definitely sure we could. Kieran, I think in case we're going to lose any connections of any kind, I think we'll call that for now. But I really, really appreciate the time that you've given to us for you know, on this interview, and I'm sure everybody else is very much appreciated for the time that you're giving on this interview.
Yes, no, thank you very much, Chris, for having me on, and always happy to support yourself and Club Zero Paranormal as well.
You're an absolutely star, and we're going to be more than happy to help support this Ghostlands, and of course we have put it onto our Facebook page, and we will promote it as much as we can. We'll put it on our website as much as we can, and we'll get to see what feedback we can get going for this for Ghostlands. But the best of luck.
Brilliant.
With it. The very, very best of luck with that, Kieran, and once again, thank you very, very much for your time. Okay, guys, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this evening on our current podcast, but thank you very much indeed for listening, tuning in. You can download and listen by iTunes or via our website at www.clubzeroparanormal.co.uk. To Dr. Kieran O'Keefe, we offer you our sincere thanks. Thank you very, very much indeed for allowing us this opportunity to speak with you and interview. We know that you're a very, very busy man. So thank you very much once again, and very best of luck with your new project, Ghostlands. Ladies and gentlemen, for those who sent us messages for Dr. Kieran O'Keefe, unfortunately we didn't get to add all of them in there, I'm afraid. Time was elapsing rather quickly, so our apologies to that, but we did manage to get some across. But have no fear, we'll use them at a later stage in a future podcast, I'm sure. But once again, thank you all, guys, for listening, and to Kieran O'Keefe, our special guest this evening, thank you very much indeed. From Chris Andrews here at Club Zero, thank you very much for tuning in. Take care. Bye bye.
Club Zero Paranormal.